Hello there, and welcome to the September edition of the IASB Update podcast. The IASB met in public between the 13th and the 18th of September 2013, and this month we were joined by members of the Financial Accounting Standards Board for several sessions. My name is Chris Welsh. I'm here today with IASB member Patricia McConnell and Senior Technical Director Sue Lloyd. Patricia and Sue will shortly provide an update on some of the discussions and decisions made during the meeting. Just before we begin, I should stress that all views expressed during the course of this broadcast are the individual's own and do not necessarily reflect those held by the IASB. So if we could begin proceedings, Sue, I think we're going to start with financial instruments.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So firstly, touching on impairment and the ongoing discussions on expected credit losses. So as Chris said, the FASB were here in person for the meeting, and we had a little bit of an unusual situation where we had a joint meeting on impairment, but where the IASB were asked to make decisions on matters that relate to the proposals that we recently put out for comment, and the FASB were making decisions on the model that they had put out for comment, but both boards were able to ask questions about the other's decision-making sessions. So on the IASB side, we looked at three issues this month on impairment. And the first one was a sort of overarching discussion about how responsive the model was that we put out for comment, and in particular when a financial instrument would have lifetime expected credit losses recognised. And the IASB clarified the objective of the model, which was to ensure that all financial instruments for which there's been a significant increase in credit risk should have lifetime expected credit losses recognised on them. And in particular, what the board emphasised was that lifetime expected credit losses shouldn't only be recognised if you can actually see at an individual financial instrument level that there's been a significant increase in credit risk. So, for example, you don't need to be able to see delinquencies before something moves to lifetime losses. You can make an assessment based on a portfolio level. And the board emphasised that that was the intention of the model, and that some examples of fact patterns where that might be relevant should be included in the final model. Two other aspects of the model were also discussed. The first was clarifying what the measurement objective should be for financial instruments that haven't significantly increased in credit risk, so stage one, as it's sometimes called in the model, and the IASB confirmed that the measurement objective for those financial instruments should be a 12-month measure, so the 12-month probability of a loss should be reflected for those financial instruments. And the final discussion we had was what default actually means in the model. In the recent exposure draft, we didn't define default, and because of the importance of the default definition to the model, the IASB decided that we should provide a definition or explanation of default in the final model. And the IASB tentatively decided that default should be measured using an approach that's consistent with credit risk management practices for a particular entity, and to emphasise that qualitative indicators of default, such as breaches of covenants, should be used where they're relevant for particular financial instruments, but there should be a rebuttable presumption that default shouldn't occur any later than 90 days past due on a financial instrument, unless an entity can show that they've got a reason for a later default criteria being indicative of default for a particular type of instrument. The FASB had a separate discussion on how to measure lifetime expected credit losses and made some clarifications to their measurement objectives. The IASB will have a similar discussion for their model at a later meeting. So that was impairment. The two boards then jointly discussed the classification and measurement part of the financial instruments project, and in particular the boards discussed clarifications to the concept of solely principal and interest for financial instruments. And solely principal and interest is basically a description of a simple debt instrument that could be eligible to be measured at amortised cost under the new classification and measurement proposals. So firstly, we discussed what principal meant in that context, and the boards decided that the amount of principal should be the amount that the current holder had paid for the financial asset when it was initially recognised. And then the boards had some discussions about what the meaning of interest should be for classification and measurement. And on that, they clarified that while the main components of interest are a consideration for credit risk and for the time value of money, that interest isn't limited to those things, so it could include things like a return for liquidity risk, a profit margin, and recovery of costs by the lender. So it's not a very, very tight definition. And there's also some discussions about what the concept of time value of money meant in the model. And essentially, the boards confirmed that it means a return just for the passage of time, so something like a risk-free rate. There were some discussions about contingent features, which I won't go into detail because they're quite specific, so it's best to look at the update for details of those. But I guess one other thing we did discuss for the ISB that's particularly relevant to IFRS constituents was the concept of interest for environments where the government might regulate interest rates. And the boards decided that regulated interest rates could be considered to be an interest rate that was acceptable for amortised cost measurement as long as it was broadly consistent with consideration for the passage of time and as long as the rate didn't include exposures to risks or volatility in cash flows that would be inconsistent with a basic lending type relationship. So, for example, if there was anything like a link to equity prices or something like that, that would disqualify the instrument, but otherwise regulated interest rates could be eligible for a simple debt investment that could be eligible for amortised cost measurement.
Sure. Thank you very much, Sue. Moving on, also on the agenda was revenue recognition. Patricia, do you care to take us through?
Sure. I'd like to give you an update on what we did on revenue recognition at the September board meeting. This was also a joint discussion with the Financial Accounting Standards Board. We discussed three topics that came up during the drafting of the final standard for revenue from contracts with customers. Those three topics were collectibility, the constraint, and licenses. With regard to collectibility, the boards asked the staff to focus on improving the current drafting and to evaluate an alternative of including a collectibility threshold in the criteria for identifying a contract that is in step one of the revenue model. With regard to the constraint, the boards asked the staff to focus on evaluating whether to provide more specificity about the level of confidence used in the application of the constraint. They also asked the staff to investigate an alternative approach that refocuses the objective of the constraint on the quality of the entity's estimate and whether or not the entity should reassess that estimate. The board also asked the staff to evaluate whether or not to reinstate specific guidance that would address the accounting for a usage-based royalty on licenses of intellectual property. That provision is known as paragraph 85 from the last ED. And finally, with regard to licenses, the board asked the staff to focus on improving the drafting of the criteria for distinguishing between a license that provides access to an entity's intellectual property and a license that provides a right. The staff is going to bring back these three topics at the October board meeting with some recommendations for the board's consideration.
Thanks, Patricia. I also understand there are some discussions regarding our disclosure initiative. Perhaps you'd be willing to take us through those as well.
Yes, there was discussion about the disclosure initiative. The staff gave an overview of the disclosure initiative, which is a follow-on from an out outcome of our agenda consultation and a public forum that we held last January. At that forum, we heard a number of commentators, both preparers and users, suggest that one of the things that was making disclosure less useful than it could be was some unfortunate wording, in the view of the commentators, in IAS 1. And so at the September meeting, the staff brought some proposals that they thought would enhance the usefulness of disclosures by amending IAS 1. And there were five suggestions for improving IAS 1 in regard to disclosures. The first was to provide some additional guidance to the materiality section of IAS 1 to clarify that the concept of materiality should be applied to the specific disclosure requirements set forth in a standard or an interpretation. That is, materiality should be assessed both for primary financial statements and for the notes to the financial statements. The second proposed amendment was to include wording in the materiality guidance in IAS 1 to highlight that disclosing immaterial information could obscure useful information. The third proposal is for paragraph 54 of IAS 1, which deals with presentation of line items in the standard of financial position. It was recommended to clarify that the line items listed in that paragraph can be disaggregated and should be disaggregated if doing so would provide relevant information. In addition, a similar amendment should be made to paragraph 82 of IAS 1, which deals with presentation of line items in the profit or loss section or statement. The fourth proposal was to amend paragraph 114 of IAS 1, which deals with the order of the notes to the financial statements. The proposal is to clarify that the order shown in that paragraph is not a requirement, but is one that is commonly used. Wording should also be included in paragraph 113 to emphasize that an entity should consider the effect of both understandability and comparability when determining the order of the notes in the financial statements. And finally, the fifth amendment is to paragraph 120 of IAS 1, which gives guidance on identifying which accounting policies should be disclosed, and that should be amended to remove the income tax accounting policy example, because that suggested to people that every accounting policy of the company should be presented in the accounting policy note. The IASB agreed with the proposal suggested by the staff, and the staff will bring further proposals at the October meeting.
Thanks very much. I think that covers pretty much all of the main topics for last week's meeting. It's been a busy month for us here, actually. We also had, in addition to the board meeting, the World Standards Setters meeting, and also the second meeting of the Accounting Standards Advisory Forum. Looking out to the next few weeks, the week of the 14th of October, we have our advisory council meeting and also a meeting of the IFRS Foundation trustees. Details of these meetings, as always, on our website, including registration details for some of the public sessions where available. A more comprehensive written update of the September board meeting is available, as always, to download also from our website. The next meeting of the ISB will take place on the 23rd of October until the 1st of November, and as before, details on our website. Until next time, thank you very much for joining us. It's been a pleasure. Thank you. Bye.